Welcome to an excerpt of the CME activity, HDL and CHD, New Mechanisms Targeting Risk, which is certified by Medscape and presented by Robert H. Eckel, MD, Christopher P. Cannon, MD, and Paul M. Ridker, MD. Dr. Eckel is a Charles A. Betcher Endowed Chair in Atherosclerosis, Professor of Medicine, Division of Endocrinology, Metabolism and Diabetes, and Cardiology, University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, Aurora, Colorado. Dr. Eckel has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Genentech, Sanofi Aventis, Pfizer, Johnson & Johnson Pharmaceutical Research and Development, GTC Nutrition, Eli Lilly & Company, Esperion Therapeutics, Amylin Pharmaceuticals, and GenFit SA. He received grants for clinical research from Sanofi Aventis, GlaxoSmithKline, and Diodexis. Dr. Eckel does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Eckel does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Cannon is an associate professor of medicine, Harvard Medical School, Timmy Study Group, Cardiovascular Division, Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Cannon has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Bristol-Myers Squibb Company, Sanofi Aventis, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, and Alnylam Pharmaceuticals. He received grants for clinical research from Acumetrics, AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, GlaxoSmithKline, Merck & Company, and Takeda Pharmaceuticals North America. He owns stock, stock options, or bonds from Automedics Medical Systems. Dr. Cannon does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Cannon does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Ridker is a Eugene Braunwald Professor of Medicine, Harvard Medical School, Director, Center for Cardiovascular Disease Prevention, Brigham and Women's Hospital, Boston, Massachusetts. Dr. Ridker has disclosed the following relevant financial relationships. He served as an advisor or consultant for Merck & Company, Isis Pharmaceuticals, Vascular Biogenics, Amylin Pharmaceuticals, and Genzyme Corporation. He received grants for clinical research from AstraZeneca Pharmaceuticals, Novartis Pharmaceuticals Corporation, and Amgen. Dr. Ridker does intend to discuss off-label uses of drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics approved by the FDA for use in the United States. Dr. Ridker does intend to discuss investigational drugs, mechanical devices, biologics, or diagnostics not approved by the FDA for use in the United States. The purpose of this educational event is to educate clinicians on the latest HDL-C clinical trials in the prevention of atherosclerotic disease in at-risk patients. This activity is supported by Genentech. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.
Hello, my name is Bob Eckel. I'm from the University of Colorado Anschutz Medical Campus, and my work over the years has been in the relationship between metabolic diseases and cardiovascular disease. Today, we're going to address the topic of HDL and coronary heart disease, focusing in on new mechanisms that are targeting risk. Joining me today are Paul Ridker, who's the Eugene Braunwald Professor of Medicine at Harvard Medical School, and the director in the Center of Cardiovascular Disease Prevention at the Brigham and Women's Hospital in Boston. And also from Boston is Chris Cannon, who's the TIMI Study Group Cardiovascular Disease Coordinator from the Brigham and Women's Hospital, and also at the Harvard School of Medicine in Boston. So today, we're going to really focus on HDL. It's a topic of great controversy. Clinicians really are quite confused. Should HDL be targeted? ATP3 said no. HDL is not a target for therapy. But ultimately, we're living in a time where there are new therapies being directed more specifically at HDL that may, in fact, incur benefit in terms of cardiovascular disease risk reduction. I'm going to begin briefly just discussing HDL and what do we really know. The initial slide turns to the epidemiology, data we know well from a wide variety of case cohort studies, where, in fact, we're looking here at relative risk of having a high LDL versus having a low HDL, and the risk of cardiovascular disease events to follow. These are data well-founded in Framingham and repeatedly demonstrating over the years that HDL cholesterol, when it's low, is an additional risk factor for cardiovascular disease, in addition to having a higher level of HDL cholesterol. Then, and more in the modern era, we turn to the statin trials, wherein the effects on cardiovascular risk based on baseline HDL really showed convincingly over a number of trials that if, in fact, your baseline HDL was low, even though you were effectively treated with statins, ultimately your risk was still higher for a secondary event. Now, HDL is a complex molecule, and I think my friends and colleagues, Paul and Chris, are going to discuss this to more extent. But anyway, HDL has thought to confer benefit from atherosclerosis through a wide variety of mechanisms. And listed on these slides are some, but perhaps not even all, of the potential mechanisms by which HDL reduces the risk for atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease. HDL has been shown to be an antioxidant. It's an anti-inflammatory molecule. It modifies prothrombotic risk factors, perhaps in part by mediating increases in prostacycline and reducing platelet aggregation. It promotes vascular reactivity by enhancing nitric oxide synthase at the level of the endothelium. Alan Tull recently shown the benefit of HDL in modifying myeloproliferative cell development in the bone marrow. And finally, the most commonly explained mechanism by which HDL reverses or reduces the risk for cardiovascular disease is the concept of reverse cholesterol transport. Here we show a very kind of nascent form of HDL, which is really a kind of a membrane, a phospholipid, an ApoA1, that is very lipid poor and has a high affinity for receptors in the periphery, presumably on the macrophage, where in fact after the binding of this disc to the membrane, it promotes cholesterol efflux from the cholesterol-loaded macrophage, giving rise to the mature HDL through the action of the enzyme lecithin cholesterol acyltransferase. The HDL then circulates and in turn returns to the liver to dump much of its cholesterol back into the liver, one of the organs of origin of HDL. Now, there's been another concept that's been developed over the last 20 years, and that's the concept of reverse cholesterol transport, also mediated by the transfer of cholesterol ester, which is in the core of HDL, to the ApoB-containing particles, VLDL, IDL, LDL. And through that mechanism, ultimately, we can see that the cholesterol may, in fact, get back to the liver not directly from HDL, but, in fact, through VLDL and LDL in addition. So that's raised the possibility that maybe blocking this effect on CETP could mediate HDL-mediated reverse cholesterol transport and be a favorable effect to reduce the risk. Now, in the last year, a new concept has evolved which may ultimately reach clinical venues, and that's the idea that the HDL level itself may be insufficient information as to how HDL works. We've all seen patients in our practices who have coronary heart disease and have high levels of HDL, the concept of a pro-inflammatory form of HDL. Well, what Dan Rader and George Rothblatt did at the University of Pennsylvania is compare a wide variety of risk factors in a large cohort of groups of patients with either no coronary disease, at high risk for coronary disease, or with angiographic evidence of coronary disease. And what Dan and the group showed that basically the ability of HDL taken from these patients to promote reverse cholesterol transport was actually a bit more powerful than the HDL level itself in assessing the current atherosclerotic cardiovascular disease burden. Now let's turn briefly to what we can do to raise HDL in our practice. You know, physical activity is wonderful and probably very important in preserving cardiovascular disease health or cardiovascular health. However, exercise's effects on HDL is a bit overrated. And if you look at large numbers of studies, the exercise effect is typically less than 10%, but still a good thing to be doing. Part of that effect of exercise probably relates to the weight reduction. But if you look at weight reduction alone, first of all, maintaining the weight loss is difficult, but there's only a modest effect, perhaps 2 to 3% in raising HDL by sustained weight reduction. Alcohol is our best tool, perhaps, but we sure want to approach the alcohol issue with some degree of caution clinically. And finally, smoking cessation, of course, is something we want all our patients to do, and the effect on HDL has been well demonstrated. Now, turning next to drug therapies and their consideration in treating low levels of HDL, we've got the following players. The niacin effect is perhaps most dramatic and actually may occur at doses that are quite lower. Fibrates are more modest, as are statins. And the statin effect on HDL very much relates to which statins are used and at what dose. Bile acid resins have a modest effect, and oral estrogens a fairly decent effect, although we are cautious nowadays in providing oral estrogens to most women who, in fact, are menopausal And finally, I think the topic that really is the focus of our discussion today is this new class of compounds, the CETP inhibitors, and you're going to hear much more to be discussed about those agents in the talks to follow. So finally, I think the point we need to go forward with is for HDL, where's the evidence that modifying ambient levels of HDL confers benefit in terms of risk of cardiovascular disease? Remember, HDL currently is not a target for therapy according to the Adult Treatment Panel 3 guidelines for the National Cholesterol Education Program. So at this point, I'm going to turn the podium over to Paul and let him continue this conversation about HDL and its relevance to cardiovascular disease. Paul?
Well, Bob, first, thank you for having me. It's a pleasure to join Chris at these events. And I think that what we're talking about today is a very important issue. We have real tension here. LDL, we all understand, is a fundamental determinant of this disease. We have spectacular drugs to lower LDL that lower risk. It's an easy puzzle. Here we've got a very complicated puzzle. As you pointed out, our standard mom-and-pop therapies, stop smoking, exercise, lose weight, don't do a lot for this particular parameter. We're very excited about HDL cholesterol because we have now new powerful drugs that may change it in a real way, and we don't quite yet have the evidence that changing it may well matter, and that's the real tension for us. And as Chris will be talking about, getting these trials together becomes the absolute crucial issue. But Bob, you made two other points I think are worth talking out with as a group. You showed the original data from Castelli in the Framingham Heart Study, and that's absolutely correct. Baseline HDL cholesterol levels are a very powerful risk marker for disease on top of total cholesterol. The tension has been, when we give someone a potent statin, is HDL cholesterol, at least measured chemically, the standard HDL cholesterol, still a strong predictor of risk? Because that's been a driver of some of this. And so the tension here is between what the data show and are we even measuring HDL correctly? So let me just walk you through some of the data that we have. There's really two papers that get widely discussed in this question. Does on-treatment HDL cholesterol predict residual risk after statin therapy? The first is from our good friend, Phil Barter, using the TNT data, which is the paper that was published in New England Journal a couple of years back. And the second comes from our trial, from Jupiter, where we had a very aggressive lipid-lowering regimen and asked the same question. And they get slightly different results. Let me take you through this. So we'll begin with the TNT data from Phil Barter, and this is the 10 milligram dose, where clearly there is a relationship between the on-treatment level of HDL cholesterol and the subsequent risk of an event. But here's the same data in the same trial when they got 80 milligrams of atorvastatin, most of us would consider a potent effective dose, and suddenly the risk is really not there, that all of a sudden when the LDL is down aggressively, they're getting a large dose of a statin, the relationship is quite different. Well, that was the puzzle we took into Jupiter. So here's the Jupiter data. Now, remember, Jupiter is placebo against statin. So this is just like the baseline.
And the population is somewhat different, Paul, too, right?
Absolutely. These are people with low LDL to begin with, right, selected because they have a high CRP. But we drive that LDL from about 100 down to about 45 or 50.
And a primary prevention trial
And primary prevention, absolutely. These data are exactly what you showed from Castelli. In primary prevention, powerful determinant of risk. So this is the baseline HDL levels, I'm sorry, the on treatment, but they haven't gotten a statin yet. But this is Jupiter, when people got their LDLs down to 45 and 50, once again, the on-treatment HDL was less impressive than had been previously suggested. Now, this was puzzling to us. So we went back and looked at all the prior trials. And in fact, it's the TNT data, the 10 milligram arm of TNT, which is the most positive study suggesting on-treatment really mattered. But the studies going back, Chris's data from PROVIT, AFCAPS, Lipid, CARE, 4S, and then Jupiter suggest maybe not as strong. Now, that being said, there's controversy in this area that's worth talking about, because the cholesterol trialist group said, well, if that's the case, let's look at many different studies and address what happens with this issue about on-treatment HDL in a group where the LDLs have dropped below, in this case, 70, and they get now a positive association. The point I'm trying to make is we're not quite as sure about this mechanism. But equally important, how we measure HDL. Is it the inflammatory HDL that you talked about? Is it an HDL subclass issue? Do we have to worry about HDL 2 and 3 and et cetera? And so what really matters here, I think, and this is why Chris's contributions are so important, the trials are going to tell us, does raising HDL independent of LDL bias fewer events? We know we have the torcetrapib experience, which was a mixed bag. And we know that estrogen, as you pointed out, didn't do what it should have done. So we have to have an open mind about this.
Well, Paul, one question I might raise before Chris gets going is the fact that most of the therapies we've used to target HDL, in fact, modify other lipoproteins. And this, to some extent, is true of the CETP inhibitors. And Chris is going to outline that for us. But if we think of raising HDL as a primary therapy, ultimately, can we make any conclusions from data that we haven't quite yet seen from the AIM-HI study yet? What are your thoughts about AIM-HI? Well, you haven't seen the data, but we all hear the results. So your thoughts about AIM-HI before we move on to Chris.
Well, we'll hear about the AIM-HI data at the upcoming AHA in detail. The public top line has been no real benefit, maybe even a small potential hazard on stroke, and so we're struggling now. But again, it could come down to how much HDL change was there, what's the delta HDL between the two treatment arms, and is that particular approach, niacin, the right approach? But you've raised a very important issue, Bob. It's not like any of these trials are isolating on HDL. As Chris will describe, I'm sure, these drugs profoundly affect the entire way cholesterol is moved, changes not just HDL, but LDL and VLDL.
So, Chris, this concept of AIM-HI, remember the HDL was raised, but the LDL was fixed at the same level in both groups. Again, not seeing the data, maybe this is a good transition for you to get into the CETP inhibitors.
Well, yeah, I think one comment or question I think that comes out is that it has not been easy in the HDL space, that in theory, if that first slide is true, that the risk ratios are 2- and 3-fold different of low versus higher difference, and yet in AIM-HI it was about a 20% difference in HDL. Things aren't falling where we'd expect them, so that's telling us it's more complicated.
Right.
The biology is also, as we've learned, more complicated. Lowering LDL is you're getting rid of bad stuff out of the body. Pretty simple. It's pulled out of the arteries and plaques are less goopy. And
it wasn't 25 years ago, though, right?
You know, but there, for HDL, it has to, in theory, be an active compound. And so then when you change it with drugs or whatnot, it may be changing how it works, its efflux capacity. So that's a big cautionary note that this is a trickier risk. The other question I have is that all of the observational data are that, and then confounding of obesity and glucose intolerance, which track with low HDL, how much are those factors actually accounting for the risks that are seen in all the various epidemiologic studies? So that makes it, ultimately where we simply have to try out, a therapy. And now that we're in the era of doing big trials, we simply get an answer. Well, there are currently three CETP inhibitors that have been in late-stage development. We'll actually hear about a fourth one, evacetrapib, at the AHA. The first one is shown in the middle, torcetrapib, and that has a very appealing-looking lipid-modifying profile, so that the LDL cholesterol went down by 24%, and towards the bottom there, 61% increase in HDL. So that's two times what niacin could do if you're able to get to high dose. So really a huge change in lipids, and then appropriate and parallel changes in ApoA and B. The two other agents that are in trials now, so dalcetrapib has a more modest effect, where the main effect is shown as HDL of a 31% increase. So that's, you know, a bit more really than is seen with niacin. Not much effect on LDL cholesterol or triglycerides, interestingly. And then we've had some experience in working with anacetrapib that has a much more profound change on HDL, so 138% increase, so more than doubling. And some people say that's so big, is it too big a change?
I think last year at the AHA, Chris, I said this is a rocket shot for the moon, landed on Jupiter or something. I mean, this was an amazing effect. So,
yeah. So, but ultimately, these are nice changes, and as illustrated here, the profile that torcetrapib created, unfortunately, did not translate into benefit, and this trial, as everyone knows, was stopped early due to increased mortality and major cardiovascular events. The study was also found, and I think subsequent work has identified, there's really an off-target effect in the adrenal gland where aldosterone is increased, probably other steroid hormones are increased. There may be other effects beyond that in the vascular wall. In any case, that as an effect may have counteracted any of the positive effects of the lipid changes. And so other molecules, so dalcetrapib and anacetrapib, have been documented to not bind to the receptor that torcetrapib does. So they're free of that off-target effect.
So effectively, it's the molecule, not the class.
Well, so far, that's what we think. And, you know, the in vitro of not cross-reacting with a potential, you know, cause of that off-target toxicity. You know, this was the safety study, the DEFINE trial of 1,600 patients with atherosclerotic disease or risk equivalents, and designed to see did anything bad happen. Is this drug, you know, tolerated well, or is it like torcetrapib? So these are the LDL and HDL effects we saw on the table, you know, profound, relatively rapid effects and sustained over time. But this was designed to really look at the safety. So blood pressure was measured lots and didn't change, thankfully. And then there were no changes in aldosterone levels or electrolytes that had also been seen imbalanced. And then the other sort of standard lipid-modifying drug efficacy parameters or safety parameters is liver function tests, and CK didn't change as well. So that looked reasonable. And then finally, the cardiac events had been increased with torcetrapib, and so this study was sized to exclude that increase in events, which it did through a Bayesian analysis. So it gives us some confidence that this agent is not like torcetrapib. Looking at the actual events, they tend to go in the right direction, so that provides us encouragement to do the real study. And so this is a study that's being led by Oxford. We're collaborating in North America with them. It's the REVEAL HPS3 and TIMI-55 study. This will be in 30,000 patients who have cardiovascular disease, so prior MI, stroke, peripheral arterial disease, or diabetes with evidence of coronary disease. We'll standardize background therapy using atorvastatin, get everyone in a run-in phase to their goal of around 70, so being aggressive, in LDL lowering and then add on anacetrapib or placebo and go for 4 years and look for major cardiovascular events. So ultimately we'll, you know, get a real answer. And we've just started this study in the last month.
So with the LDL target of the 70, that's why you need 35,000 patients to do this study, despite the major changes in anacetrapib. Was it powered on the HDL change or powered on the idea that if LDL is also further reduced, there might be additional benefit?
Well, an interesting thing, we don't know if this would work on the HDL because we don't know if HDL works.
It's tough to power that on HDL.
Intriguingly, this is a very good LDL lowering therapy. And so a lot of the power calculation was said, well, let's just set aside whether HDL works and would this give us enough power? Obviously, with this number of patients and follow-up, mm-hmm. we'll have lots of power. Interestingly, though, as Rory Collins says, we're looking for compelling evidence also of safety. And so one needs the tens of thousands of patients to really know if this is something that's going to modify atherosclerosis that would apply to hundreds of millions of people. We need a really decent-sized trial overall. Now, the other agent that's in testing is dalcetrapib, and in addition to the lipid changes we've seen, there are other more detailed assessments of HDL biology. I have to admit, I don't fully understand them, but I'm trying my hardest. What has been postulated here in this one initial paper, and I understand others are working on this, is that there may be differences in how the different agents inhibit, or a term being used is modulate, CETP. And so in this cartoon illustration from this paper, it illustrates that with dalcetrapib, there appears to be more movement of the CETP across the different things, so there's more nascent, or the HDL, the empty garbage trucks, as we folks sometimes talk about it. So that sounds like it would be a good thing, but ultimately, even the HDL pharmacology experts don't really know what it means, but interesting, some differences amongst these different agents. So at the ESC, there were two studies presented, both small initial safety and, you know, assessment of efficacy trials. This was done by Tom Lusher's group and presented dal-vessel, where he looked at flow-mediated dilation and found no difference between those who got dalcetrapib and placebo. And so no harm was part of the concept here. In theory, there wasn't any benefit either, but you know, it's a modest-sized study. Another study that was presented and then published in The Lancet was dal-plaque, and this looked with various imaging parameters at a modest number of patients, looking with PET for inflammation in arteries, and then also with MR for plaque size and atherosclerosis extent. They looked at a whole slew, and this is only some of the parameters that were looked at, and found, you know, the top line there of one of the endpoints was total atherosclerotic burden in the imaged artery with MR, and that seemed to be slightly lower, and less progression was seen with dalcetrapib. They excluded harm, and so that's in the blue box, and that was one of the goals, is to say there's not an increase in atherosclerosis with this class. That's one of the questions with torcetrapib. But the ultimate answer will come from an outcomes trial, and this is well along the way, started back in 2008 and listed to complete in May of 2013. It's an add-on onto background statin therapy in patients post-ACS who are then going into their stable phase. So we'll know from these trials whether these therapies work, and then probably with that we can try and figure out how they might be working.
Well, you know, it raises this question like we raised with niacin with anacetrapib, because there's so many other changes occurring to really suggest that the change in HDL is independent of the further lowering of LDL. May be difficult. It's going to be post hoc in terms of the types of analyses that are done. Paul, what are your thoughts about this whole issue of dalcetrapib versus anacetrapib? We've got a compound, dalcetrapib, that looks like it's going to be targeting mostly HDL, wherein we may get a better answer to this question.
Well, I must say I look at this a little differently. I think that I don't actually see these as HDL-raising trials. I see these as trials of CETP inhibition.
All right.
And I see niacin as a trial of a different pathway. Sometimes we get lost in that because we're trying to put a simple label on a very complicated set of compounds. These drugs profoundly change cholesterol transport. They change a number of these biomarkers. And so I think Chris has made a very important point, which is at the end of the day, whether any of us choose to use these drugs down the road is not going to be because they necessarily raise HDL or lower LDL. We're going to use them because there's a 15-20% relative risk reduction for our patients, there's a good safety profile, and we think that on top of a potent statin, there's going to be an efficacy. It's really the only way right now that we can deal with this. Now, in clinical practice, we're all left with, what do I do with my high-risk patient? I have them on a statin, their HDL is low. So now we're back to the tension of being a physician separate from being, you know, the research setting.
And the topic before us here today is HDL,
right?
That's right. So even though we may have these ultimately pleiotropic effects, right, we still have to come back to HDL. Is it a target for therapy?
Right. And so it makes sense that a lot of us use a lot of HDL-raising drugs in the meantime.
Do you use HDL?
I use them in a small number of patients where I just have a sense of concern, particularly a high-risk individual where I have to say to them, I'm not sure I'm necessarily doing the right thing. I think, from what I understand, it's the way to go. And then we keep track of these trials.
Chris, are you convinced that CETP is the way by which we should modify HDL favorably? In other words, all these potential mechanisms by which HDL may confer benefit, are some of these other ones also important? And we're going to miss some of that with the inhibition trials?
Well, I frankly can't speak too much to it. I think one concern with CETP inhibition is that it does create the large HDL molecules, which in theory are the full dump trucks. And so can you put more cholesterol in a big puffy HDL molecule? And there's fortunately been a lot of work done and some just published this week saying that these are functional molecules. So even though they're big and would come out as in the epidemiologic studies as the wrong size HDL particle, that they actually do work, and so the efflux or a recent animal study showed that cholesterol actually makes it out of the body with CETP inhibition. So that's been one of the concerns, that will they work, and I think so far they look like they should.
Okay, good. Paul, any further thoughts about mechanisms of raising HDL? Does it make any difference how we change it? And of course, again, we're not quite sure that changing it is beneficial. Your thoughts?
Well, I think that it's been a very interesting couple of years. If we go back not just to AIM High, but to ACCORD, and we can read that as an HDL trial if we want to, and we have a beautiful set of data about what fibrates might do and what PPAR mechanisms might do, with a disappointing result, at least from the setting of, did they study the right patients? These are the questions that always get answered. And then we have to ask again, why estrogen, which really does, as you point out, have a lot of interesting effects here.
Oral estrogen.
Oral estrogen, thank you. And so I think it is clear how we shift whatever that molecule is seems to matter. It's true in LDL. I mean, I think, again, notion of statins have been just magnificent drugs. I think we're very lucky. But we still aren't quite sure that other mechanisms of LDL reduction, pharmacologic mechanisms, are necessarily effective. And so we're waiting. And it's been a very interesting time.
Well, along that line, I mean, the bile acid sequestrants were our first definitive trial, right? And they worked. And so ezetimibe raises questions we haven't totally answered yet. So the jury is out kind of on other mechanisms of LDL cholesterol lowering. I think I would tend to believe that they're also going to work, but yet we have to have the proof before us. So as the clinician faces a decision about changing HDL, I think he or she needs to consider the evidence for raising HDL as an independent
risk factor to modify favorably, and we don't have it yet. And the exciting path we're on right now is we have a new class of drugs that are really before us now being put to test in the clinical trials, and Chris is really a major part of that game, and we're looking on with great interest in terms of the results. So Paul and Chris, I really want to thank you both for the excellent discussion. I want to thank the audience too for tuning in to what we consider to be a very important and timely topic in cardiovascular disease risk and risk reduction. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this excerpt of the CME activity, HDL and CHD, New Mechanisms Targeting Risk. To participate in the CME activity, please go to medscape.org/features/audio and select the title.